peeling back the layers of the onion, it gets really stinky. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me in our studio is the co-host of our program, Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Yeah, and this isn't one of those sweet Vidalias that you can pick up and eat like an apple. This is more like a purple onion that once you cut into the skin, baby, your eyes water. You are crying from the minute you start slicing it.
Well, or either that or you have no tear ducts. And that may be the problem with some of our friends, Chuck, is they may not have any tear ducts. What are we talking about, ladies and gentlemen? No, we're not talking about cooking and gardening. This hasn't become the Rachel Ray or the Paula Deen program. We are actually talking about what we normally talk about, biblical worldview as applied to our world around us. And in this season, I guess is a good way of putting it, Chuck, what we call the silly season, applying it to politics. Now, we've talked at some length about politics. As a matter of fact, if you listen to the last couple of days of our program, we were talking about how some people are trying to convince the supporters of Ron Paul that they need to come over and vote for Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan on the Republican ticket because that's the way to stop collectivism and to move forward with their libertarian agenda. Well, as we were doing the research for today's program, I came across an article that I looked at and I read and I fired it over to Chuck and I said, you know, look at this one and let's take a look at this because I'm seeing this as a potential of moving the ball in order to attract those independents, those Ron Paul supporters, to the Republican ticket. And what I'm talking about is an article that was published here just a couple days ago in the CNSnews.com website, which is one of the favorite places Chuck and I like to go to get some background information for our prep for our shows. And the columnist's name is Pete Wynn, and he wrote this article headlined, Paul Ryan, that's Mitt Romney's running mate, Paul Ryan says he's now okay with gays in the military. And I looked at this and sent it originally to Chuck to look at on the surface text of, hey, Chuck, isn't it interesting how maybe some of our friends who are very quick to be all rah-rah about Paul Ryan being on the Romney ticket and helping to make the pill easier to swallow, because these are the same people who less than a year ago were dead set in many instances on making sure that Mitt Romney wasn't the nominee because they liked somebody else, and fill in the blank there, Sarah Palin, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich. I mean, the list went on and on and on. And each time the lists, they seemed to settle on one that was right before the person dropped out of the race. So I looked at this as, and some of these folks may be feeling a little bit dyspeptic about this whole thing right now because that pill may be regurgitating on them and they're getting a bitter taste in the back of their throat.
Yeah, it's the acid reflux.
Could be the acid reflux of jumping too quick to endorse somebody because you believe in boogeyman politics. Well, boogeyman politics, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've mentioned this on the program before, but here's a refresher course. Boogeyman politics is when you look at somebody and say, ooh, ooh, look at the person in power. They're so bad, we've got to do anything we possibly can do to get them out of office, including holding our noses and voting for the lesser of two evils and a guy we don't like and who, if we had our choices, we would rather vote for somebody else, but because he's the only guy there is and he's the only one electable, we're going to vote for him. And that's boogeyman politics, and it's very similar, Chuck, you know, especially since we talk a lot about our social conservative friends and our Christian conservative, pro-family, pro-life group friends. And I love every one of these people, ladies and gentlemen, and we're not going to name any names, but we've got some friends who, honestly, that's their political math. That's how they calculate these things. And it saddens Chuck and I because they're really not coming from a fully orbed biblical worldview as they're making political decisions. It's almost like there's a mental separation between their beliefs and their politics.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And we're going to be running something, hopefully, if we can get permission, we're going to be running something that talks specifically about this issue at the end of our show. But that being said, you know, you and I have talked for a long time, Barry, and we're trying to figure out how you can go from last December. This is 9 months ago.
Yes.
We're in the middle of the primary season where we're just starting with the Iowa caucuses and getting ready for the New Hampshire primary. And what do we have to do? We have to stop Mitt Romney.
That was their whole mantra.
I mean, everything that was going on, it has to be anybody but Mitt. If it's Mitt Romney, well, then the end is on the horizon. It's all over. We're just
stick a fork in it. We're done.
Yeah. Kill me now because we're all going to die.
And now 9 months later, we're all in it for Mitt.
Exactly.
Which I understand that, Chuck. But again, like I think I mentioned to you offline, this is similar to how many conservative groups send out fundraising letters.
Yeah.
It's called the show me a devil strategy, where you basically point out something that's, oh, totally horrible to get people to feel good about the alternative.
Right.
And, you know, honestly, a lot of groups use that, and it's a strategy, ladies and gentlemen. But honestly, when it comes to Christianity and our address and our approach to politics and government, it's a bad strategy to use. So now I'm feeling that maybe they've got a little bit of this indigestion, this acid reflux, as you mentioned, because the darling of the social conservatives, Paul Ryan, who got picked as Mitt Romney's VP running mate, and everybody seemed to think, oh, that's going to make it so we just coated the pill with sugar so it can go down easier. He's now come out, and we're not kidding, ladies and gentlemen, because this happened last weekend. He was televising an interview with a TV station in Florida because he was down there. It's a swing state as well, so he's down there campaigning. And they ask him the question about the whole issue about don't ask, don't tell, since this week was the one-year anniversary of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And they ask him very seriously, where do you feel about this now? And he said, well, you know, at the time I talked to combat leaders and they didn't think the timing was right and when our troops were in the middle of harm's way. But he says, now that it's done, and for full disclosure, Paul Ryan, when he was a congressman, when this came up a year ago, voted against the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Okay? He's on record as voting against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But he says, now, so we're going to turn the clock forward a year. So a year later, he says, and I quote, now that it's done, we should not reverse it. Yeah, you heard me right, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Ryan has now flip-flopped. He is now saying, oh, well, now that we've repealed it, we need to hold on to the repeal. And he says, and I continue this, I think that would be a step in the wrong direction because people have already disclosed themselves. Chuck, that's probably one of the weakest excuses for a flip-flop on your position that I think I've heard in a long time.
Well, Barry, our show will be on the air for a year.
Sweet.
October 3rd.
Yes.
That's our first anniversary. And the fact is that when Don't Ask, Don't Tell came out, which was very early on in our broadcast career here at Principles and Policies, we talked about the fact that we were sort of marveling that when this policy, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, first came out and everybody was saying...
In the Clinton administration.
In the Clinton administration in the mid-90s, the Christian community was like, we can't allow this to happen. We cannot allow Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because the earlier policy was, you're exposed as a homosexual, you're out.
You're discharged. You're out of the military.
Now, all of a sudden, we come full circle to Barack Obama deciding to eliminate Don't Ask, Don't Tell as a policy and just say, if you're gay, serve. Then all of a sudden, we had all the evangelicals crawling out of the woodwork and saying, we can't lose Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Mm-hmm.
And Barry, you and I, as I recall on this radio show, said, no, we need to go back to the original policy.
Oh, that's right.
That is, if you self-identify as a homosexual, you cannot serve. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. We're not going to go into that. But here's Ryan, given his chance to go back to the original policy, the one that worked, and all of a sudden he's, well, we can't do that.
We can't reverse it. It's a step in the wrong direction. Now, okay, ladies and gentlemen, why we named this program today Peeling Back the Layers of the Onion is because we're going to do just that for you today, because as we started, and as I mentioned, I was throwing this out to Chuck as the idea that, okay, the campaign has found a theme that they want to run with, and they're trying to soften their positions in order to make themselves more palatable to the Ron Paul-type supporters, the independents out there. In other words, they're trying to get votes for this. But as we got to digging into this, something else came out that I believe was much more important and I think much more accurate as to the reason why a year later, Paul Ryan, who's now the vice presidential nominee on the ticket with Mitt Romney for the Republicans, is doing a 180 on his position on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He went from voting against repealing it to saying, oh, well, now that we've repealed it, we just need to leave it alone because people are vested in this. Well, the reason why we did some digging is because, as on the comments on that blog, on that website, on CNS News, a name kept popping up. And that name is Paul Singer. Now, I'm sure our audience probably isn't really fully vested in who Paul Singer is because, unlike you, Chuck, not many of them have an extra couple of hundred million to store around in hedge funds to let Mr. Singer manage for them.
Oh, if only. The Institute for Principal Policy wouldn't be two guys sitting in a basement with a couple of used microphones recording on a junk Toshiba computer.
But if you have a couple hundred million you want to give to us, we'd be more than happy to take it. But anyhow, Paul Singer is the head of Elliott Management Corporation, which is one of the country's biggest hedge funds. This guy's a multi-billionaire from New York State, and he also happens to be a lot of other things, Chuck. The very first thing he happens to be is the biggest donor to the Romney campaign. Okay, the biggest single donor to Mitt Romney's campaign. He's given more to the Republican Party and its candidates so far, and this was the article from the Wall Street Journal, ladies and gentlemen, so we're moving on here to the Wall Street Journal. Their article of Monday, August the 27th by Gene Dugan and Brody Mullins that showed that he's given $2.3 million just this election cycle to the GOP, including $1 million to underwrite the Republican National Convention, and another $1 million, and I got this information from opensecrets.org, yes, that you can go find people where they donated to federal candidates, that he gave $1 million to Romney's Super PAC, which is also known as Restore Our Future. That's Mitt Romney's Super PAC. And back last year, a year ago, in October, he handed $1 million to Romney's Super PAC. He was vested in Romney a long time ago. But according to this article from the Wall Street Journal, Paul Singer has a couple of other interesting points about him.
At least a couple.
The first one being he's also the single biggest donor to Congressman Paul Ryan.
Isn't that interesting? Suddenly we go from Mitt Romney to Paul Ryan. Now, gee, why do you suppose Paul Ryan got chosen as the
VP nominee?
As the VP nominee?
Because Mr. Singer was a major financial backer. And honestly, that was one reason that it happened, according to sources, that his support helped Paul Ryan emerge as the vice presidential nominee. But Singer had approached Paul Ryan early on to ask him to run for president, that he would back him financially. Now, this is interesting considering Paul Ryan's record on certain issues, specifically gay rights issues, because that's Paul Singer's other claim to fame. He's one of the biggest single funders to support homosexual marriage legislation at the federal and at state levels. He's given, since 2001, he's given over $11 million to campaigns and to organizations to press for legalizing gay marriage. Why? Because Mr. Singer's son is homosexual and got married to his partner in the only state that allowed gay marriage at the time, the state of Massachusetts.
And let's be clear about why Massachusetts was the only state. The fact is that it was the only state because Mitt Romney wrote an executive order requiring
the judges to uphold it
and the clerks of courts to provide
gay marriage ceremonies.
To issue the licenses,
that's right.
And the fact
as governor at the time, Mitt Romney was the single driving force in getting gay marriage legalized in the state of Massachusetts.
That's right. He didn't have to do it. There was a court order that came down from the Massachusetts Supreme Court that said that the law was unconstitutional. There's a problem with that, though, Barry, in that in Massachusetts, according to their constitution, the Supreme Court cannot change written law.
Oh, well, that's one of those paper barriers, Chuck.
That's right.
That's one of those paper barriers.
Well, that's right.
And, of course, since the judge has to be an umpire calling balls and strikes, as we said on an earlier program, that rule book, that constitution, they don't have to follow that. They have to feel for the nuances of the game and maybe call a wider strike zone or a narrower strike zone depending on who they want to win.
Exactly.
And that's going back to another program. You go to our archives to hear that. But the other link that Paul Singer has is not only is all of his money invested, not all of it, but a lot of his money invested in Mitt Romney and in Paul Ryan, another name came up in the Wall Street Journal article. Folks, this is how Chuck and I do our research. We start finding and tracking these little threads until we figure out what the tapestry looks like. And then we come and we describe it to you, sort of like the Bayeux tapestry. So another name popped up in the Wall Street Journal article, and it's a gentleman by the name of Dan Sr. Now, Dan Sr. works for Paul Singer at Elliott Management Corporation. He's married to And this comes from the Daily Kos blog site, which is a horrible leftist liberal organ. One, you hear Rush Limbaugh screaming about the Daily Kos all the time. But basically, they did an interesting bio piece on Dan Sr., and that he's married to Campbell Brown, who's the former CNN anchorwoman. So we got all kinds of things going on here. But the big thing is that Singer's employee is a major political strategist to the Romney campaign, and as a matter of fact, is the senior strategist to a certain Paul Ryan.
That's right. He was Paul Ryan's chief advisor during...
Chief policy strategist, as Paul Ryan now has flipped his position on a significant plank in the homosexual rights movement's agenda.
Now, this brings up a question, and that question
it brings
is...
a lot of questions.
Well, lots and lots and lots. But I'd say the most salient question right now is, how did Paul Ryan, who has a record as being in favor of traditional marriage, how all of a sudden does he become the darling of someone like this senior character and
Paul Singer?
Paul Singer.
Yes.
Because Singer...
It's hard because we got two Pauls. We got Paul Ryan and Paul Singer.
Paul Singer.
But they're not nearly that far apart, it seems like now.
Yeah. And my question is, this guy was willing to pump all this money into Ryan, and he was being advised by Senior. And how did Singer get the idea that maybe Paul Ryan might be amenable to a change in his position?
I would assume it would have had to have been with conversations with Dan Sr., who happens to be one of Singer's chief political advisors. He seems to be a neoconservative wunderkind who is deeply connected to another neoconservative who our listeners might have heard the name before, Bill Kristol. Bill Kristol is a pro-war, pro-libertarian viewpoint on many social issues, and he was known as a neoconservative, which means that he's not truly a conservative in the sense of the word that we would consider conservative, which would be both social and fiscal. He's a fiscal conservative when it suits him, and socially, well, I don't want to be bothered with all that stuff. Let people do what they want to do. But so here, looking at the map, you got Bill Kristol, who was instrumental in helping the Romney campaign choose the person who Romney wanted to run as VP. Kristol was on the inner circle team that was advising Romney on which of the people, including Ohio's Rob Portman, and you had Chris Christie, who was mentioned. You had Paul Ryan.
You had Marco Rubio.
You had Marco Rubio, who are all considered the finalists in this VP sweepstakes. Paul Ryan came out on top. Well, it would be interesting, since Dan Sr. is his chief policy advisor, and Sr. works for Paul Singer, and Paul Singer is Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan's biggest single campaign contributor, and who's now given over $2.3 million to the GOP, including underwriting their convention.
Well, it looks to me, okay, it looks to me like
the numbers are starting to add up, ladies and gentlemen.
Basically, it looks to me like Paul Ryan came over with a strong box full of money.
Oh, absolutely.
And promised, if, this is the key, if he would maybe change position slightly on his pro-life stance, which he already has.
Which he already has.
He now
is soft to the rape and incest exception.
And now, and before, let's put it right up front. Paul Ryan at one point was pro-personhood.
Yeah, for legalizing personhood.
You can't have personhood and rape and incest exceptions. Those are incompatible positions.
They are.
You're either, there are two positions that you can really have on abortion. You're either pro-life or pro-choice, and choice being a bad word, you're either pro-life or pro-abortion. There are no in-betweens. Don't let anybody fool you that somehow rape and incest exceptions are a compromised, nuanced position. There is no such thing as a nuanced position on abortion.
No, there's not.
You're either for it or you're against it.
That's right. Now, Chuck, one of the things that our listeners need to understand about this is that Mr. Singer is very, very forthright about his support for gay marriage.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's actively engaged his money in this fight. As we said, $11 million he's been given to pro-gay groups like the Human Rights Campaign and others. But he actually went a step further. He's now bankrolled a super PAC that's for Republicans. Now, this super PAC called American Unity PAC, he's given, and we looked it up on opensecrets.org, he's given over $1.1 million to in the last 4 months. Okay? So he's now created this new pack, and its sole mission is, quote, and this comes from the New York Times article by Frank Bruni, which all these will be linked on our website. You can find all these articles and these links. That, quote, he's providing $1 million to start a new super PAC with several Republican compatriots. Well, one of them is Ken Mellman, the former head of the Republican National Committee, who came out as openly homosexual.
Yep.
And worked in the George W. Bush administration as his, I believe, I don't know if he was the chief of staff or he was the communications director. I think he was communications director.
I think he was communications director.
So anyhow, they formed this PAC, and its sole mission is, I quote, to encourage Republican candidates to support same-sex marriage. You can't get any more forthright than that, Chuck.
No,
that's what
can't.
They're looking for. And now, how are they going to do this? Well, they're going to, in part by, and I quote from the article, in part by helping them to feel financially shielded from any blowback from well-funded groups that oppose it. Read, social conservative pro-family groups who would possibly think that Paul Ryan flipping on gay rights issues might be reason enough not to support him or to try to run him out of office if he were still a congressman. This group's going to fund and throw money at them to keep them financially shielded from that kind of response.
Like Focus on the Family.
Family Research Council. National Organization for Marriage. I mean, I can go on and on.
Institute for Principled Policy.
Yeah, we're going to throw our millions into that. That's exactly right.
Well, but you and I both, we do throw our time, talent, and treasure, as minuscule as it is available. We do that.
Well,
so,
that's true. That's true. We try to help out as much as we can. But basically, from this article by Bruni in the New York Times, he said that our conversation, that's his conversation with Paul Singer, reflected a growing awareness among prominent Republicans that embracing marriage equality, that's their word for gay marriage, could broaden the party's base and soften the party's image in crucial ways.
Yes.
Chuck, that's right. It would be crucial because I think at that point you would probably lose, well, maybe I'm overstating this fact. Maybe you wouldn't lose many of those social conservative groups if you just told them the right things. Because this information's out here, ladies and gentlemen. It took us maybe 2 man-hours total, tops, of doing research by Googling up some names and following a couple of threads to try to figure this out. And we got it pretty well buttoned down. There isn't any reason that some of our friends in these national groups who've got researchers on staff and they're paying for them couldn't have come up with this to vet these candidates ahead of time. I'm just very concerned about that.
Well,
but I want to go back to this because one of the things they said, as Singer said in this article, he says, and I quote, there's a feeling among some people that the Republican Party is harsh on some things. And then he also said that the opposition to same-sex marriage is atmospherically and tonally, he said, it's part of the landscape of so-called harshness. In other words, he's trying to get the Republican Party to be a kinder, gentler, bigger tent party by coming out publicly and embracing gay marriage and getting rid of DOMA and not trying to pass a federal marriage amendment. And he's actually using the super PAC. They're going to attack. Chuck, we said this for a long time to our friends.
Right.
We said it on this program. Guess where their first target is, where they think they can make the best impact and have the most policy impact with this new super PAC? They are going to be targeting congressional races.
Of course.
They're not targeting presidential, although Paul Singer is putting in lots of money into the presidential race and specifically into Congressman Paul Ryan's coffers. But they're going to target congressional races because he said there are more than a few Republicans, quote, who could be on the verge of support or are, quote, harboring and hiding their views.
That's right. So basically what they're doing is adopting Karl Rove, big tentism. And remember what Karl Rove brought us. He brought us George W. Bush, who basically betrayed all conservative principles during his tenure. Don't kid yourself if you think we got good Supreme Court justices out of that. First of all, you're not going to get anything like that out of Romney. And second of all, John Roberts didn't turn out to be so hot. In any case, the number of questions I have go well beyond the amount of time that we have for today. But the fact is, I have to ask, what other issues are the Singer and
Dan Senior?
Dan Senior.
Well, it's interesting because in talking about these issues that the Republican Party is harsh about.
They need to be
smoothed out and made kinder and gentler. Gay marriage was only one of the topics.
Right.
Some of the other ones included immigration and abortion.
Yeah, immigration, I seem to recall abortion. There are others, certain kinds of fiscal policy having to do with, I'm sure, welfare issues. Let's face it, Barry, this is a worldview battle.
Absolutely, it's a worldview battle.
And in fact, what's happening is that Christians are being suckered into supporting a team whose players, nobody knows who they are. And the fact is that Senior and Singer are not going to be as upfront as Karl Rove was with George W. Bush. The fact is they're going to be behind the scenes whispering into Romney's ear, whispering into Ryan's ear, whispering into these guys' ear and telling them, don't go conservative. Don't go conservative. Don't go conservative. Well, you don't have to yet. You don't have to do it until about 18 months before the election. Then, when it's time to get reelected, suddenly they make right-hand turns all over the place and come back into the fold just long enough to make sure there's no primary challenges, and then voila, we're back to the races. Barry, this happens over and over and over and over and over again.
Well, what's the old chestnut that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing you've always done in the same way you've always done it and expecting a different result. Sadly, ladies and gentlemen, and biblically unfaithfully, many of our friends in the social conservative world have been doing the same thing they've always done in the same way they always do it, and they always expect another result. As a matter of fact, I think we're going to be sharing with you an interview that was done by a friend of ours, Kevin Swanson of Generations with Vision Radio. We've been graciously granted the permission by Kevin and his producer to replay this interview in its entirety with Steve Dace, who is himself a talker, a radio guy, who's written a book called We Won't Be Fooled Again. And he interviews him about the book, but they really get into worldview issues. And as Chuck and I were sitting here talking and doing a pre-record on this earlier, we started listening to this program and thought we couldn't say it any better, so we asked them if we could let them say it to you.
Let me give you some background. I've actually been interviewed by Steve Dace.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about that.
I've been on Steve Dace's show. He gave me a half an hour, I think, and we talked to him when we were talking about constitutional convention issues. So I know Steve Dace is he very self-deprecating, talking about his lack of education. Well, he's a smart guy, so don't be fooled by that. And he asked me some tough questions, and I think I gave him back some good answers to those questions because Iowa, if you recall, was a state which had issues with their Supreme Court suddenly saying that gay marriage had to be acceptable. It was unconstitutional to ban it. And he was asking me about whether Iowa needed to approve a new constitutional convention. I said, why don't you try your constitutional remedies first, was the gist of the operation. And in fact, that's what happened. And you know what they did? They threw out the Supreme Court justices, all of them, who voted in favor of this thing. So that's my experience with Steve Dace. He's a good interviewer. He's a good radio host. And apparently he's very smart about worldview issues. Now, real quickly, this is on the Generations with Vision radio program. You can go see more about them at www.generationswithvision.com, all one word, generationswithvision.com. The host is Kevin Swanson, who's a pastor in Colorado, a homeschooling father, and I would suggest that you listen to his program. I am a constant listener to Kevin Swanson's program. It is a great program. It's called Generations Radio. And I would suggest that you get a hold of Generations with Vision and listen to their radio program. We're going to play the entirety of this interview. It's the last half hour of the show.
And welcome, my friends, to the Generations Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you. Coming to you from my basement out here in the Eastern Plains of Colorado during the demise of Western civilization, the breakdown of faith, family, and freedom in the West. But it ain't over. It ain't over. Hey, there have been tough times in the history of mankind, and we have had our backs to the wall a number of times in history. Hey, at the founding of this nation, it wasn't as if there was a majority of people saying freedom's a great idea. There was a handful of people that got on a boat. Half of them lost their lives in the way over and the first year there in Plymouth Colony. But over time, a nation was formed. Took a little work, took some sacrifice, but they pulled it off. These things can happen again. That's the point of my book, The Second Mayflower. It's been done before. It can happen again. There is a God in the heavens. He helps courageous, faith-filled people accomplish amazing things. That's pretty much the theme of the Word of God as well. So, hey, let's just bring this to bear again in our lifetime, and let's give our children, our grandchildren a vision for what can happen, what has happened, and hence the Second Mayflower. Well, ladies and gentlemen, today we want to talk a little bit about the religious right, because the religious right, I tell you what, I had some hopes in the religious right. That's one reason I ran for governor in 1994, was because James Dobson said, I will not vote for a single candidate who will sentence one innocent baby to death by abortion. I said, amen. I ran for governor of Colorado so that James Dobson and Kevin Swanson could have somebody to vote for in the 1994 gubernatorial elections. As it turns out, I lost. Got 4% of the vote, but that's okay. About 4% of Coloradans still believe that life was an important value. And I made a point. But since then, what in the world is happening to the religious right? That's the question today. There are actually three responses to this, to the question, is the religious right over in this country? The first answer is no. It's not over. They're just, you know, trying to get organized. The second is yes, and we're happy about it because Christians never belonged in politics. Just leave politics to the libertarians and the socialists. We don't need to bring any of these biblical principles to bear in the civil sphere. Okay, that's the second answer. I'm getting those kind of answers from places like Westminster Seminary on the West Coast. They're saying, yeah, religious right is over, and they're celebrating, and they're saying because Christians never belong to politics. The third answer is, yeah, actually the religious right may be over because their agenda was wimpy, watered down, unprincipled, and worthless to begin with, and it turned out the religious right was just another irreligious, unprincipled bunch. So that's the third response that we're getting. But how does this saying go? How does that old saying go? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me 485 times, I'm a complete idiot. It's kind of the way I'm looking at elections, and I'm looking at the religious right. It seems to me they've been fooled more than 485 times, probably thousands and thousands of times. And it could be because a conservative Republican walks into a restaurant and says, I'd like to order a little less than whatever that Democrat's having over there. Have no idea what he's having for dinner, but I want a little less than whatever the Democrat has, which, I mean, you've got to draw the conclusion that this guy has no idea what he wants. This guy has no basic principles, no basic agenda, no basic direction for where he's headed. And this may be why we elect George W. Bush, who increased the size of the Department of Education threefold, way, way more than Obama could ever, ever accomplish. And of course, we had the biggest increases in domestic spending under George W. Bush than we had with any president since Lyndon B. Johnson. He gave us the socialists that tempt the scales in socialist medicine with Chief Justice Roberts. And it seems to me that the direction that that is set by the Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals together, is inevitably a direction towards more homosexuality, more abortion, more socialism, more of the same. And it seems to me that Romney is one of the very, very worst of the candidates we have seen to this point. Hey, we've got a guy who's got a record. I mean, never mind the rhetoric. Again, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me 485 times with your rhetoric. As politicians, I'm a complete idiot. We don't listen to rhetoric. We don't go to rhetoric. We don't care about rhetoric. What we care about is a guy's record. And the guy's record is pro-homosexual, pro-abortion, pro-socialist. Hey, he got more accomplished with the liberal agenda in Massachusetts than Obama has gotten with his nation in the last 4 years. So what in the world could we expect with Romney as president of the United States? I shudder to think of what could possibly happen if he brought the agenda he brought to bear in Massachusetts into Washington, D.C. All right, so that's my venting for the day. But we're going to go to the phone lines with somebody who's got some similar opinions, but he's got a different take on this. He's written a book called We Won't Get Fooled Again. Steve Dace is a syndicated radio talk show host. He's got a bigger program than me, spans the nation, works with Salem somewhat. And here's the weird part of this guy. He's principled. He's got a vision for victory. He doesn't want to lose as slowly as possible as America becomes a socialist, Nazi, pro-homosexual, pro-abortion, pro-big government nightmare of a state. So, again, Steve Dace is the author of the book, We Won't Get Fooled Again. Steve, welcome to our little Generations program.
Kevin, it's a pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yes, and I love your book. It's great. I mean, you're talking to the religious right in your book. I mean, it's a series of interviews that goes through, I mean, it's all kinds of interviews with different people representing the religious right or the conservative element of the country. What's your overall take after doing these interviews?
A couple of things I came away with. Number one, it's actually more bleak. It's worse than I thought it was. From the outside in.
Huh.
And as my show has grown and I've had a chance to meet some of these people and interact with them in our natural habitat, to go to meetings like CNP, for example, and some other places, it's worse than I thought it was, number one, even when we finished the manuscript of this book about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is the lack of worldview of many so-called Christian leaders is astonishing. I've only saved me about 10 years ago, Kevin, and probably have only taken my faith really seriously from a worldview perspective in the last 5 or 6 years. And I do not say this, please, I hope your audience understands. I just turned 39 years old. I don't say this out of any sense of arrogance.
Okay.
But I am blown away by how much further advanced my worldview is than many of the people that are leading our causes. Simple questions like, how many children can a Republican kill and still be pro-life?
Mm-hmm.
They just aren't equipped to answer these questions. And you see this throughout our book, is often the way that the questions that we pose to these leaders are answered is usually with some form of pagan utilitarian imagery, similar to when your kids in the government schools are given an ethics test that says there's 10 people on a boat and they'll all die unless you choose which four to throw overboard to save the rest, and here are their biographies and you choose which ones ought to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially the utilitarian ethic that is really being perpetuated by a lot of our leaders. And you see this in the colossal failure. I mean, regardless of whether you agree with all of our theology or all of our philosophy or the tactics that we suggest we ought to do differently in the conclusion of the book, this part is incontrovertible. Mm-hmm. And this is why J.C. Watts told us, the former congressman in Oklahoma, when he read the book, he said, listen, every conservative, every Christian in America at least needs to read the first two chapters by them. And then, because they need to understand, I mean, look at all the activism we've done, all the money we've spent, all the candidates we've helped get elected. The government's much bigger than it was before we started this. The culture is much more pagan and secular than it was before we started this. Judges are more out of control than they were before we started this. Spending and taxes are much higher than they were before we started this. The schools are much more pagan and anti-American than they were before we started this. Literally everywhere that we have tried to fight, it is worse off than it was before we were formed as a movement for the 1980 election cycle. And when we ask these leaders this, their best answer is, that's all true, but it would have been even worse had we not been here. And they're, you know, to be fair to them, they're right. It might have been more, it might have been worse. That we'll never know. But here's what we do know.
Okay.
We didn't win, Kevin, on anything. And if anything, we've actually lost. And as Dr. Lawrence White said in a recent talk that I attended, we've actually caused enmity to the name of Christ to the American people, who now just see Christianity as little more than a partisan political tool. And men like Pat Robertson and men like Jerry Falwell, for better or for worse, are now better known, even though Falwell, of course, has passed away. He's still better known than men like John MacArthur or John Piper, for example. And they are seen, Ralph Reed, Pat Robertson, they're seen as the face of Christianity in America.
Yeah. It seems to me that bad worldviews yield bad strategy. Some of these guys had some minor points dialed in, but what you're saying is their basis for ethics, their foundational approach to ethics, the foundation, the footers, and their ways of thinking really, really bad. So if that be the case, they're probably going to wind up with really bad strategies and bad organizations with bad effects.
One of the things we've done as Christians, and our leaders have done this, and we've followed suit, is we have properly put a lot of emphasis on the ideology that we're trying to advance and the ideology of the candidates we're trying to elect. Meaning, what do you believe?
Yeah.
Okay, and listen, absolutely, that is important. It is a biblical command. Always have a ready defense for the hope that you have, right? Always be ready. We just talked to Josh McDowell on my show today. I mean, this is a guy that's made a career out of having a ready defense, right? Yeah. So we always have to be able to defend what we can believe or what we believe. But where this whole thing breaks down, Kevin, okay. is in the methodology.
Okay.
How do we carry out what we say we believe? And so the ideology is very biblical. It's absolutely in line with the Judeo-Christian moral value system. Where this whole thing breaks down is in the methodology. This is now where it is. We're going to try to play God's game by the devil's rules. We're gonna play within the framework of a pagan fallen system. We're gonna pour new wine into old wineskins, to borrow a biblical metaphor, if you will. And that's where it breaks down over and over again. You know, we often, let me give your audience an example. You try to support a true conservative, like you were talking when you ran for governor, right?
Yeah.
And people went out and supported you and you didn't win. And those people thought, I'm not going to support the establishment rhino hack again. I'm not getting fooled again. And then the general election campaign starts and you hear that general election Republican articulate a viewpoint so much closer to yours than the Democrat, so they rope you back in again come November, and then in January and on from when they take office, you're left with a government that looks exactly like almost what you opposed, and you're wondering, how did this happen? And one of the things we learned writing this book is there is a difference between a biblical moral view and a biblical worldview.
Uh-huh.
A biblical moral view is an understanding of where right and wrong comes from, what that is, and who we're ultimately accountable to for it. A biblical worldview now is, how do I fully integrate that in a way that honors God so that he will bless my efforts? How do I do works with faith and not, or excuse me, how do I do faith with works and not works with faith?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it breaks down.
Yeah.
Many of our leaders, many of the candidates we nominate and elect have a solid biblical moral view, which is why they articulate a worldview much closer to ours compared to the Democrats. But when it comes down to actually implementing it, their worldview is actually much more pagan than it is biblical.
Steve, could their pragmatism be tied into a lack of faith in God, in God's sovereignty over history?
Sure. I mean, if you look at one of the interviews we did on the program with Tom, or we did on the with the book, was with Tom Minnery, Focus on the Family.
Yeah.
And he literally tells us in this book, I mean, your listeners can read it for themselves. And he literally says, well, we tried to pray for the kind of leaders that you would like us to have, but, you know, God didn't answer that prayer, and he didn't finish his thought, but the implication is, well, therefore, we had to just go out there and do this ourselves. I mean, that's the implication. And so, yes, I think there is an absolute lack of acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God, and I don't believe, I really think this is a spiritual stronghold the enemy has on us within the system that we have to break through, because I have seen otherwise brilliant Christian men like Dr. Wayne Grudem, for example. I've seen otherwise brilliant, absolutely solid Christian men, and what, for whatever reason, when it comes to the realm of politics, all biblicism erodes immediately. Almost like stuff we would never tolerate in our homes, in our children, in our families, in our businesses. We suddenly, when it comes to how we're going to govern ourselves, we tolerate a level of paganism that we would never tolerate anywhere else. Imagine if a young man went to a pastor and said, Pastor, I want to marry this young girl in our youth ministry. We're adults now. I want you to marry us. But you know what? I just want you to know, I'm going to do marriage fidelity with exceptions. And listen, I'm only going to cheat on her from 1 a.m. to 2:30 a.m. on Thursday nights. It's a relative statistical anomaly. And the rest of the 99% of the time, I'm going to be faithful to her and a loving husband, and she'll put up with it. And you have to acknowledge it, simply because, you know, if she marries somebody else in the youth ministry, they might cheat on her even more. At least now, well, she's not being cheated on as much. The pastor would say, that's preposterous. I'm never going to marry that couple. But that's essentially been our pro-life strategy for 40 years. And we accept a level of compromise and paganism when it comes to politics we accept nowhere else. We otherwise lose our minds, frankly. And the only thing I can think of, Kevin, is this is a spiritual stronghold of the enemy that we're just going to have to break through.
Well, I think American Christians have given way to a fundamental ethic that's more pragmatic and utilitarian, as you said before, than it is based in God's laws.
Well, let me
They're
take
driven
one issue.
By it.
If you don't mind, let me take one issue with what you just said,
yeah.
If you don't mind.
Okay.
I hesitate to call all of this pragmatism.
Mm-hmm.
Pragmatism is doing what works. Okay,
yeah.
This has been a failure.
Yeah.
I mean, and
it's bad pragmatism.
Yeah, tell me, this is defeatism at a slower pace. I mean, to me, what's more pragmatic than saying God is in charge of the whole universe? He's the only undefeated entity in all of of the universe, so I'm going to side with him every time. That sounds pretty pragmatic, if you ask me. Side with the guy that wins 100% of the time. This isn't pragmatism. What we're doing here is defeatism at a slower rate. That's what this is.
Steve, the enthusiasm with which the religious right is rushing in to endorse Romney on the part of just about every single religious conservative I know, except maybe Mike Farris, have just been breathtaking this time. I mean, way more breathtaking than it's ever been before. The panic, the enthusiasm to get behind Romney, is this an admission to defeat? Are they finally saying, we are defeated?
Yes. I think that your question that you asked, is the religious right dead? No. Is it changing? Yes. And, you know, one thing I can tell you is I get invited to some of the meetings now that people read about in press accounts,
mm-hmm.
and I have many friends that attend these meetings as well. And one of the things I can tell you when you look at this group of people, with a couple of exceptions like a Tony Perkins, for example, everybody in this movement is either on an iron lung about to get fitted for one, or is 26, 27 years old, just out of law school, just out of the military, and wants to run for office one day. The lack of men, you know, my age to your age, in this movement is staggering.
Wow.
We have lost an entire generation. Mm. And so what will be very interesting to see is, as some of these leaders now fade away, as age, of course, catches up to all of us, is what will take their place. And you can see in the next era of American Christendom, really, that there are three things I think we're going to see take place.
Okay.
Number one is, you're seeing on college campuses all over the country in the last 10 years an enormous growth of liberalism, masquerading as emergent church, masquerading as which it's really just a new variant of panentheism or polytheism. So you're going to see some of that.
Yeah.
Then you're also seeing an explosion of Reformed theology in 20 to 30 year olds.
Yeah.
And this is where you see guys like John Piper and Tim Keller and Mark Driscoll and some of these guys have or Paul Washer. These guys have podcasts, or the White Horse Inn, podcast numbers in the millions, dwarf what me and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Mark Levin and all these nationwide hosts have for listenership combined.
Wow.
But one of the things a lot of these guys also have in common is an amillennial eschatology.
Yeah.
So they're very, very biblically convicted. They will preach all of God's word when it comes to the moral law from their pulpits, but they really believe that they really have an allergic reaction to the compromises of the religious right.
They're backing away from politics, yes, too, it seems to.
Yes, they are. They're preaching a strong word of God on every aspect of the word of life, but they really have an allergic reaction to all the moral compromises of the religious right, so they're leaving that all alone.
Yeah.
Listen, they'll preach about abortion and homosexuality on what the Bible says and that it's wrong, but in terms of, that's why you've got to do something about America, it's very hands-off, city of God, very Augustinian, you know, eschatology where that is concerned. So you're seeing a massive growth in that. Now, the third thing you're going to see is a complete revolt of the political system altogether. And I would probably represent this. I would probably have a more Reformed theology, but I have a more activist, application methodology of my faith. But what I think you're going to see, and this is where the growth of shows like mine come from, is a total rejection of partisanship, a total rejection of access-based, seat-at-the-table stuff. But instead, the new religious right will not be as massive or big and well-funded as the last one. It'll be better organized, better strategically, more targeted, more like, it won't be a mass army, it'll be more like a Navy SEAL. And these are people that I think will wreak havoc on the ruling class system in both parties. And you're already seeing some of these leaders emerge, and they're making some of the old guard religious right people just as uncomfortable as they're making the left.
Who are the good guys? Give me some names. The guys who are still standing in a brave feud, still standing up for the cause of principle at all levels.
You know, it's interesting. This is where real discernment, I think, comes in. I mean, and this is where you don't have to agree with everybody to think that they're still standing.
Right.
I have a lot of respect for the work Joseph Fair and World Net Daily does. I wouldn't necessarily call myself one of the birthers, but I like the fact they're willing to ask questions, tough questions, challenge people on the right. I have a lot of respect for them. I think when you look at a lot of the worldview stuff that Focus and the Family has put out over the years, like the Truth Project, for example, that stuff is very, very solid.
Yeah.
We use a lot of their worldview stuff in our homeschooling when it comes to things like Adventures and Odyssey and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to actually application, like CitizenLink, I would avoid that, frankly.
Yeah.
I would urge Christians to avoid that.
Okay.
That's sort of where we do everything right until it comes down to when we're actually going to do that which we say we believe.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Michael Farris. I know Michael well.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for him.
He's a good guy. He fights a lot of the good battles.
He is. And there's also tiers of this, too. Kevin. There are some of our guys, like Gary Bauer. I mean, Gary Bauer is one of those guys, God bless him, maybe this is harsh, but I can't imagine trying to encourage any young Christian male to be like Gary Bauer when he grows up. And what I mean by that is Gary Bauer is going to find whatever Republican the liberal media says can win, in other words, write out the check, and he's going to support that person. Yeah. And then there's people who will fight in primaries, and they'll try to help principled candidates. And then once the primary is over, they'll say, hey, we still have to defeat the Democrat. And so I bring up all these things because it's not just as simple as an either or. You know, you have to look at people's lives in context, and you have to do that with people like you and I. You know, we're not right on everything as well.
Yeah.
But what I have a tendency to do is, to me, there's one tier of people I eliminate right away. Anybody that tried to tell me in the last two primary cycles, I had to vote for Mitt Romney and I had to vote for John McCain before the primary was ever fought. I just eliminate them, right? I just have eliminated them.
Steve,
I
mean, what about the 40% of young evangelicals who went for Obama in 2008? What about that? I mean, they're attending evangelical churches too.
Sure. That is the rise of the panentheism, the emergent churchism that I just alluded to. In fact, I would challenge any pastors listening to this. You know, if you really want to be shocked, stunned, and dejected, corner all the children in your youth ministry, and I don't care how funny, I don't care if you put the fun in fundamentalist, okay? Mm-hmm. You corner the kids in your youth ministry, especially if they're going to government schools, and you ask them what they really think. Ask open-ended questions. Stuff like, is it okay if, as long as two people love each other, is it okay what gender they are? And I think you'll be shocked, stunned, amazed, tragically disappointed at what they really think, and that's what you're alluding to.
And you know what's happening? They're plugged into the matrix. They've got their earphones. They've got their pop culture. And what about these Republican Christian conservatives sending their kids off to public schools for an indoctrination to make sure that they will vote for a communist in 2025? You know, there's a disconnect. I think the fundamental problem with a lot of these religious conservatives is they were not willing to go to the belly of the beast, which obviously is the education system that's rooting and grounding kids in a proper socialist, humanist, materialistic worldview for the first, 18, 22 years out of their lives.
You mentioned the belly of the beast. One story that didn't make it in the editing process of our book, I sat down with somebody who was a very high-ranking member of John McCain's Faith and Values Coalition in the 2008 campaign. We sat down for lunch once. And this woman told me that, she really thought she was doing what Daniel did, serving a pagan king, standing up for the cause of Christ, and being principled, and there was nothing wrong with what she was doing in helping John McCain win the presidency. And I just asked her a simple question. Did Daniel help the pagan king be a better pagan? Did Daniel say, hey, when all prayers and supplications go to the pagan king, then I guess all prayers and supplications go to the pagan king because I've got to cut the best deal I can get, and, he's the one that's in charge right now. Is that what Daniel did? I said, wait, do you challenge John McCain on anything? Do you think Daniel would just sit by when John McCain went on Ellen DeGeneres or when John McCain's campaign manager, Stephen Schmidt, went to the log cabin Republicans and said, under John McCain, your day is going to come on the issue of gay rights? Is that what you think Daniel would do? And see, these are the rationalizations we are making in this system. Here's the reality. In any negotiation or in any war, whoever cares the least about losing usually wins, Kevin. Usually wins. Yeah. I'm sure you've been in a lot of business negotiations.
Yeah, sure.
And the entity that cares the least about losing usually gets their way. Right now, we are up against a worldview that is more convicted in what they believe than we are. They are willing to die and lose elections for what they believe, and we are not, and that's why we're losing.
Obviously, politics isn't everything, Steve. I mean, we've got to have strong families and churches as fundamental for a Christian socioeconomic system, but politics is something, and this is something we're hanging on to this in lieu of what some of our other Reformed friends are doing. We're still hanging on to the fact that Jesus Christ is Lord of all, including and politics isn't everything. We're not socialists. We don't think that government solves all problems. But politics is important for some things. What do you think? What would you tell a Christian running for political office as a congressman or as a state senator? What's his agenda? What does he do?
I've had, Kevin, countless men and women running, Christian men and women running for office, come to me, call me on the phone, and ask these kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And I've always asked every single one of them this question, okay? It's this one. Tell me what you can't do. Tell me what you can't do. Because when God revealed his law to Moses, what did he give him a list of? What he can't do. The law begins with what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what the boundary is. Tell me where the fence line is. Tell me what you can't do, and then we'll reverse engineer it back to what you can. And a lot of times they can't answer this question for me because the standard in this arena is not objectively what is good, what does the Word of God say. It is subjectively, which is I'm not as evil as somebody else. Mm-hmm. And as Christians, we will never be able to thrive in that environment, Kevin, because we're not wired for that environment. We are called and wired to challenge that environment. We are to challenge that system. We are to say, here I am. I can stand, you know, I can say no more. May God have mercy on my soul. That's what we're called to do. Mm-hmm. And what disturbs me is often they can't tell me what it is they can't do. Like how many babies can you vote to kill in a bill mm-hmm. and still call it pro-life? How many? I mean, how much of other people's money can you steal and still not be stealing according to the Ten Commandments? Which mm-hmm. is it? And we haven't thought through these questions. We don't have a list of what we can't do. And therefore, since we don't have a list of what we can't do, I'm sure most of your listeners who have children, and I have three, we have very specific lists for our children in our while they're living in our house what they can't do, right?
Yeah.
And yet, when it comes to governing all of civilization, what's the one thing we don't have? Yeah. What we can't do. Right. And I think that's very problematic, and there's something else I see, too.
Okay.
You know, a young man will go to a pastor and say, hey, I'm thinking about getting married. Will you disciple me on what God expects of me as a husband? And he will. That young man, maybe a few years or a few months later, will go back to that pastor and say, hey, we're going to have a child, and will you disciple me on what God's word says about what I'm supposed to be as a father? And he will. Then that young man may start a business, maybe work in a business, be successful, feels a call to run for office, and he'll go to his pastor and say, you know, I feel like God's calling me to be a public servant, to run for office, to stand for righteousness, but I'm not sure how to do that or what even righteousness is. Will you disciple me on what that is and what God expects out of me as a minister of his justice? And the pastor will look at him and say, God bless you, son. We don't do politics in the church.
Yeah, so I ran into that myself when I was in politics.
Yeah, we don't disciple people, and then when they go there and act undisciplined, as an undiscipled, we yell and scream, hey, you guys aren't standing up for the truth. Well, you didn't tell me what the truth was.
Right, right. And that'd be preaching from Genesis 9 and verse 6. People need to understand the basic function of civil government is to hang murderers who are convicted of, you know, killing, murdering with hate in the heart and lying in wait and all that. But you're not taught about the basics. And what are your priorities, though? You know, you're looking at somebody in politics. Is it defending God's people, defending home education, defending the churches to preach the word of God, no matter what it happens to be? They won't be arrested for hate crimes. Is it abortion, personhood amendment kind of stuff that I've been advocating? What are the things that hit you? I mean, top five, six right away.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And here's why I say it that way.
Yeah.
One thing I've never had in all my years doing this, whether it was on the Blowtorch WHO in Des Moines or on 45 radio stations across the country every night. Okay, here's one. Let me tell you, I've never gotten this call, Kevin. You tell me if you've ever gotten this.
Okay.
Hey, Steve, save all the babies and pass Obamacare. You ever gotten that call, Kevin?
No.
No. Hey, Steve, gay rights and, man, make sure that I've got concealed carry laws in my state. You ever gotten that call?
No, no.
No, I never gotten that call.
No, no. Too inconsistent.
Yeah. How about, hey, Steve, yeah, man, we've got to protect the borders and taxpayer-funded child killing on demand. You ever gotten that call?
No, huh?
No. Now, why is that? Well, because the issues I just mentioned are connected. They're interwoven in a worldview, and the other side recognizes that.
Wow.
Okay? And our side does not. So I don't think it's a question of principles and priorities. It's a question of a worldview. It really is, to borrow a phrase from our Catholic friends, it really is, in some respects, a seamless garment.
Mm-hmm.
These things have to work together. We cannot deviate from the script. You know, David Barton's done a lot of good work. I know he's under fire right now, but one of the things he's done over the years is he's charted the voting patterns of Republicans and Democrats in Washington, D.C. And what you will find is that the more pro-life they are, the more small government they are. Mm-hmm. And the less pro-life they are, the more big government they are. That's not a coincidence. That is a worldview issue.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we can extrapolate priorities. Obviously, in certain circumstances, certain things become a priority, like the Ronald Reagan line of, hey, you know, the right to life, if I don't have that, all the rest of my rights are kind of a moot point, and I would agree with that. That's why I'm a personhood guy as well.
Sure.
But the reality is, it's a worldview issue, and that's what I love about personhood.
And a guy
personhood
who's,
is a worldview issue.
And a guy who's consistent is going to be principled. A guy who's principled is going to be consistent to that worldview. He's inconsistent, he's unprincipled, and not worth supporting.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very
good.
So powerful.
There is no such thing Boy, let me just tell you, it's up there with unicorns, jackalopes, and pro-life Democrats, okay? There's no such thing as a social liberal fiscal conservative. It doesn't exist.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, the book is We Won't Get Fooled Again, the author Steve Dace, available on the web. Steve, thanks so much. I want people tuning into your stuff. I think it's stevedace.com, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Kevin.
There are others out there, my friends, who are saying something similar to some of the stuff we say on this radio program all the time. Steve Dace from stevedace.com, last name spelled D-E-A-C-E. And the book is available online, We Won't Get Fooled Again, Where the Christian Right Went Wrong and How to Make America Right Again, available on the web at stevedace.com or anywhere else. Ladies and gentlemen, you can interact with our radio program by emailing me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. You can also hear the program anytime, anywhere in the world at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.
As we mentioned at the beginning of this segment of the broadcast, that was Kevin Swanson's Generations Radio program. And you can hear more of that at www.generationswithvision.com. And Kevin Swanson is a pastor out of Eastern Colorado. And as you heard there, the interviewee with Steve Dace, D-E-A-C-E, Steve Dace. Steve Dace is a syndicated radio show host. He's out of WHO in Iowa. And as you can hear, he's frankly got it all together regarding worldview issues. I would get in contact with Kevin Swanson and Steve Dace. I would get Steve Dace's book, We Won't Get Fooled Again. And with that, I would ask you to join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.